Today's scripture reading is Matthew 6, verse 19 to 25. So, yeah, let's read starting from verse 19. Do not store up for yourselves treasures on earth, where moths and vermin destroy, and where thieves break in and steal. But store up for yourselves treasures in heaven, where moths and vermin do not destroy, and where thieves do not break in and steal. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. The eye is the lamp of the body. If your eyes are healthy, your whole body will be full of light. But if your eyes are unhealthy, your whole body will be full of darkness. If then the light within you is darkness, how great is that darkness? No one can serve two masters. Either you will hate the one and love the other, or you will be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve both God and money. Therefore, I tell you, do not worry about your life, what you will eat or drink, or about your body, what you will wear. Is not life more than food and the body more than clothes?
In the 1960s, a US town called Rosetto was an anomaly in America. No one under 55 had died of a heart attack or showed any signs of heart disease. The local death rate for men over 65 was half the national average. A team of researchers led by Dr. Stuart Wolfe considered whether this was because of their diet, location, family history, or exercise habits, but on the surface, nothing was different from the rest of America. In fact, the town was made up of Italian immigrants who worked in quarries and factories, smoked unfiltered cigars, and had dinner tables laden with rich Italian food. Rosettans of the 1960s still held on to their old world ways. It was normal to find three generations under the same roof. 80% of men in the town were members of at least one community group. They would gather in each other's kitchens, play cards, and simply talk. The conclusion? Rosettans were nourished by each other. Over the next decade, the multi-generational homes broke up, and by 1971, when opulent houses, expensive cars, and swimming pools appeared, the first person under the age of 55 died of a heart attack. By the 1980s, the rate of fatal heart attacks in Rosetto was the same as the rest of the country.
Many people don't have an extended family that they see regularly. They don't have two or three generations of people who live in a neighborhood together. They don't have a church or synagogue they go to regularly. They don't have a job that they've been at for many years. And we all know that these things affect the quality of our lives, but they actually affect our survival, and to a much larger degree than we had once realized. And so what we've learned is that it's not enough to focus on the behavior. It's not enough just to give people information. We have to work at this deeper level. You know, the number one most commonly prescribed prescription drugs in the US and probably in most of the world have been antidepressants for the last 10 years, because there are a lot of depressed people out there. Now, a skeptic might say, oh, come on, give me a break. You mean sitting around talking about my feelings, you know, is somehow going to help me live longer if I've got cancer? Please. It's so easy to make fun of these ideas. Oh, these are, you know, we're just so touchy-feely, you know, but we are touchy-feely creatures. We are creatures of community. That's how we've survived as a species, is by learning how to care and love and nurture each other. And we ignore those ideas at our own peril.
So the Rosetto community has become a really fascinating case study. They've actually called this the Rosetto effect. In addition to those health implications you heard about, the community had zero crime rate, zero, and no one in the community ever applied for public assistance of any sort prior to that. So it's really the penultimate example of how we started off our series last week and what we talked about, that, you know, since like World War II, the trajectory that North American culture has taken has just led us to this place where community has been destroyed. And quite literally in Rosetto, when the fences went up in the neighborhoods, that's when things started to go downhill. It's pretty incredible. And so we have become, you know, kind of cultured to be these individualistic people who are consumers. We feel entitled. We are intensely private. We are protective of what we have, right? That's pretty self-condemning, but if you think about it for yourself. Before the pandemic, even back to, you know, 2019 and earlier, how often would you have a conversation with your neighbors that lasted more than 5 minutes? How many of you, have any sort of feeling or sense of commitment to any other person outside of your own house or your own family? How frequently would you have somebody else in your home or invited to come out and do things alongside you? You know, when you would encounter problems, how much more likely would you be to pay a professional or rely on some system to resolve it rather than going to your community or your neighbors? We've become so focused on what's inside of our own fences, you know, our homes, our comfort, and the whole sense of security that all that provides. And that's why I wanted Kevin to read Matthew 6 this morning. So I don't know if I can outdo Kevin's scripture reading, apparently. That was pretty amazing. But I wanted him to read that because I think, you know, we don't often connect the dots between verses like that and our ability to love our neighbors. Because the truth is, if we're not actively loving our neighbors, then we're probably doing a lot of those things that scripture verse talked about. We're storing up, you know, earthly treasures rather than heavenly ones. I don't know about you, but I feel that a lot. I sense that a lot. I walk around our neighborhood and, you know, I look around at houses and I go, wow, how can they afford that? And I see renovations happening. I go, oh man, I wish we could do that. And I'm just measuring what I have against others. You know, and then, you know, I'm trying so hard even for what we have to maintain that and to create and keep the standard of living for my family that we've got and to preserve that and protect that. So that's what we're talking about in this series, Next Door as It Is in Heaven. And all that kind of stuff is the premise of the book by the same name that we're kind of leveraging for this. I actually picked up this book at a conference because back in 2017 it was, because I had heard the two authors give a couple of sessions. I attended a couple of sessions they gave, and I was just so challenged by it at the time. That's back in 2017, you know, just to consider even then how isolated we were becoming and just how hard-hitting this messaging was. And, you know, they talked about how the church itself as a whole across North America is, you know, missing the mark in some ways. You know, they said God's church doesn't have a mission. God's mission has a church. We get that backwards. And we don't go to church. We are the church. We are all sent people, not just the missionaries, not just the pastors. Right? They also talked about the fact that loving your neighbor doesn't mean you have to do something entirely different, but maybe we need to think differently about where we're actually at. So this was all really challenging. And then, you know, back then, who would have thought a few years later that we would enter a two-year-long period in which we're practically confined to our own homes, and we're actually being told that contact with other people is reckless, it's irresponsible, it's potentially harmful. Like, that was crazy thinking back then, but here we are. And so today in week two of our series, we're going to talk about tearing down the fence. Now, the staff really wanted me to literally rage and tear down this fence. And you do too, obviously, but I don't think you thought this through. If I get too close to this, it's just going to fall over on its own. Like, this is a very delicate fence. It's not going to play out the way you think. It's going to be very anticlimactic. So I think we'll just stick with the metaphor. For the Rosetto community that you saw in that video, quite literally, again, when those fences went up, it actually happened in tandem when they started building up their homes and putting up fences and becoming more private. That's when things started to fall apart. And so that's why we're using fences as a metaphor in this series. It's they're representative of all those barriers that we put up that prevent us from having true, genuine community. And so to talk about tearing down the fence, I'm going to address kind of three, what I'm going to call fence posts that we need to take down, using just some basic practical advice that I actually pulled out of the book that we referenced. And so those three are fear, individualism, and busyness. I think we all can recognize that these things take place in our lives and prevent us from loving our neighbors. So let's start with the first fence post of fear. Now, fear might sound dramatic, but I think fear is at the root of pretty much every sin in our lives. It involves some kind of fear and probably some kind of pride as well. And so let's be honest, when it comes to loving our neighbors, fear does play a part. We have fear of rejection, right? We're afraid of putting ourselves out there and what might happen. There's fear of the unknown or fear of the stranger, right? They call that xenophobia, the fear of stranger, when it's an actual full-on phobia. But I think we all have a mild version of that, right? I think there's also just a fear of sacrifice, a fear of the effort that maybe it's going to take to go out there, to do this stuff, to be vulnerable, to give something of ourselves and our time to this effort. You know, I think a lot of us feel these kind of feelings when we look around our neighborhoods. And then we can also look around and say, well, it seems very overwhelming to look around my neighborhood and see, I got to get to know these people somehow. Like, where do we even begin is the question we'll ask. And I thought this was great. In the book, they talk about Mother Teresa. And it gives a very simple place to begin. book says, Mother Teresa said that the secret of not letting herself become overwhelmed by the masses in need was that she didn't see the masses. She saw a person in the midst of the masses, and she took her cues from Jesus. So if you think about that, you know, Jesus, as he taught and as he grew in popularity, crowds were coming to him for healing, to see what this was all about. But he didn't seem, and when you read the Gospels, he doesn't seem overwhelmed by it. He doesn't seem like he's trying to minister to them all, right? We see him take very specific action. You know, in a funeral procession, he notices the weeping mother of a young boy that's just being carried off to his burial. Off to the side of the road, he notices a man up in a tree who Jesus knows needs an encounter from him. Passing by a tax collector's booth, he sees the man inside that everybody else ignores because they hate his kind, right? Jesus always saw the individual. There's another really interesting thing that the book references to next door, as it is in heaven. They talk about the tribes of Natal in the northern part of South Africa. They said they have a very common greeting, and I don't know if I'm saying this right, but Sanbona, and it basically means, I see you. And then often the common response is Sikhona. Again, don't know if I'm pronouncing that right, but it's I am here. So that's their version of hello. I see you, I am here. And so the idea is like, until you see me, I don't exist. When you see me, you bring me into existence. And that is a very, very kind of cool thought that applies to what we're talking about today. Matthew 5, Jesus talks about the importance of seeing each other and greeting each other. He says, if you greet only your brothers, what more are you doing than others? Do not even the Gentiles do the same? Right? If we're not seeing the stranger, the other, then what are we doing? And it's very interesting because it tied to that kind of that South African greeting. The word greet in Greek in these verses means to receive joyfully, to welcome, to draw to oneself. That whole, you know, bringing into existence, it's pretty cool. So if we're going to be the light of Christ in our neighborhoods, we need that kind of attitude to take that very first step and acknowledge and see our neighbors, to bring them into existence, so to speak, at least in our own awareness, because we're probably ignoring them. It's neat, the book also references a Canadian magazine article from Maclean's magazine in 2014. So this is, again, going back pre-pandemic quite a ways. It says, it's a new day in the neighborhood all across the Western world. More than 30% of Canadians now say they feel disconnected from their neighbors, while half of Americans admit they don't even know the names of theirs. An Australian sociologist investigating community responses in the wake of the 2011 floods in Queensland found relations in a precarious balance. Neighbors were hesitant to intrude even in emergencies, leading the scholar to conclude that we are less likely than ever to know our neighbors. Quite right, too, a recent poll of 2,000 Britons found a third declaring they couldn't even pick their neighbors out of a police lineup. Again, that's from 2014, pre-pandemic, so just think how much worse off we must be at this point. I thought that was very interesting, too, the mention of the floods in Australia, this idea that neighbors didn't even want to impose on each other in the middle of a crisis when people need each other the most. They're still shy and they're still standoffish. And then I think to ourselves, we just went through a crisis where we were actually even being told not to interact with each other, not to come together. So I don't think we can underestimate what a huge impact and setback this has all been over the last couple of years. But at the same time, there's huge opportunity. I was actually just saw on the news, they did a report talking about the fact that Canadians are saying now they have even greater trust in their neighbors than they did before the pandemic. The pandemic has actually given us more trust in our neighbors. I guess we're starting to see that we do need each other more than ever. So I'm going to suggest that the very first step we need to take to get over this idea of fear is simply to get to know our neighbors' names. I mean, we probably didn't know a lot of them even before the pandemic. And maybe as we kind of come out of this, we just need to make the first thing first, right? So don't underestimate this either. Don't underestimate the power of simply knowing somebody's name and how important that can be. Right before the pandemic, actually, like the week before, there was a concert in Milton at the Milton Arts Center. I'm a huge fan of the Tragically Hip, and there was some performers there, and one of the members of the Tragically Hip were there, so I was really excited. He was doing a little solo bit, and he came out in the lobby in the intermission to just meet some people, so they created a lineup so people could come up and get a picture with him, that kind of thing, so I got in line, and it came to my turn, security, you know, calls you over, and I think, okay, I'm going to go up, do this awkward thing, get my picture, and be able to say, hey, I met this guy, Gord Sinclair. But as I walked up, what he did was, without hesitation, as I'm approaching, he sticks his hand out and says, hi, what's your name? And I was like, it took me back a minute, because I thought I was just going to get a quick pick and get out. But he asked me my name, and then we had this exchange, and it became a human exchange all of a sudden. It wasn't just me with this, you know, kind of who I looked at as a celebrity figure, you know, somebody I'd followed since I was 15 years old, right? He wanted to know my name. And it was like that South African greeting, right? It's like he brought me into existence. Gord Sinclair right now knows who I am and is calling me by name. So it's very cool. You know, the Bible also shows us the power in knowing someone's name. God does this. God knows our names and he calls us by them to lift us up, to draw us into himself, and to create intimacy and belonging with him. Look at this in Isaiah 43. But now, O Jacob, listen to the Lord who created you. O Israel, so he uses two names now, the one who formed you says, do not be afraid, for I have ransomed you. I have called you by name. You are mine. That's pretty powerful. God called Israel, called Jacob by name, this community of people, and said, you are mine, you belong to me, I know who you are, I know your name. So getting to know somebody's name, it may be a very simple seeming step, but it's a powerful one. But you know what, let's be honest, it's also a scary one. I get that too. So I think if you're intimidated by this idea of approaching somebody you don't know, asking them your name, maybe it's a neighbor you think, I should know their name, and now I'm really embarrassed that I don't know their name. We just need to do this. We need to listen to Jesus and follow him. You know, think of what Jesus did. He left the abundance of heaven, humbled himself to live a human life on earth just to come close to us and to know us. The book says he moved into the neighborhood. They pulled that from the Message translation that we looked at last week of the first chapter of John. You know, we need to do the same. Jesus calls us to follow him, so we need to do the same. We need to humble ourselves to do the hard, uneasy, uncomfortable work getting to know people, getting to know our neighbors. And usually when we do this, we're going to realize that our neighbors, they probably felt the same way we did all along anyway. They felt embarrassed that they should know our names and that they haven't taken a step to figure that out and to do it, right? So with each fence post we're going to take down today, I'm going to give you just some simple action steps. And I'll have these actually all summarized on a handout when you leave, or you can get it on the Church Center app that you'll see on the screen later. So I'll explain that later. But the first action step is to get to know your neighbor's names. And one of the ways you can do that is with this little graphic. Some of you guys will remember this. We did a series on another book called The Art of Neighboring a few years ago. So if you remember that, you maybe did this once, but you maybe need to do it again. I need to do it again because we have new neighbors. Things have changed since then. But the idea is this is your house and you should find out the names of 8 neighbors. For most of you, it's going to be the 2 on either side, 3 across the street, and 3 along your backyard. Get to know those 8 names. So what we did, going back to when we did this first time, we did this around Christmas time, so our family, we just cooked up a bunch of little baskets of cookies, took them door to door and said, hey, we've been living in the neighborhood a few years. We don't know your names. Here's ours. Introduced ourselves and got to know them. And you know what? Of course, everybody was super receptive. Everybody felt the same way we did. In fact, a couple months later, like now moving beyond Christmas into the following year, into the spring, one of our neighbors shows up at our door with a bunch of like jams and things that they had homemade. They felt so horrible that they had not taken any steps to get to know us that when we showed up at Christmas, they felt even more horrible. And they were like, we got to do something. And so it took them a while to work up the courage and they came to our house and did the same thing. So you'll see that people feel the same way you do. So we can take down that fence post of fear. The second one could be the trickiest. The second fence post is individualism, right? I say it's the trickiest because this is something that we maybe don't see that well. It's so ingrained in us. We've been raised in it. We've been formed by it in our entire lives. But here's the truth. You know, we're conditioned to operate from what the book says calls a place of scarcity rather than a place of abundance, like a place of insecurity, a place where we feel that we just assume we lack the resources we need for our day-to-day lives. And so we're always striving, always working, always earning. You know, we're always pursuing more, whether it's more comfort, more security, more success, more satisfaction. We always feel we don't have enough, and that's what our culture tells us. And then we're taught to rely on professionals and systems and money to buy the things we need instead of relying on the community around us and our neighbors to help us. We're made into consumers with a me and mine first attitude. And then once we do achieve what we think we need, then we work so hard to protect it and kind of hoard it and not let it escape us, right? It's ours and we're entitled to it. And so we've been taught to think like citizens instead of thinking like neighbors. And if you think about that, that's all very different than the worldview we see in the New Testament. These people who lived a life touched and transformed by the risen Jesus lived completely differently. Again, that's why I wanted us to read Matthew 6 this morning to get some perspective on that. But the followers of Jesus at that time, they lived with values like these. We'll put them on the screen. You know, Paul wrote to the churches saying, "No one should seek their own good, but the good of others. Do nothing out of selfish ambition or vain conceit. Rather, in humility, value others above yourselves, not looking to your own interests, but each of you to the interests of the others." So how do we today shift from this, you know, very self-focused to an others focus? Well, next door to As It Is in Heaven book, it suggests we look to something called relational proximity. We already live in geographic proximity to our neighbors, right? We're close to them physically. But relational proximity is probably something like what the early church had. It has a few dimensions, so I'm going to walk through those real quick. There's a few different shapes. First one is directness, proximity in contact. This is like the next step beyond learning your neighbor's names. This is beyond waving across the fence or the driveway. This is up close, face-to-face contact. You guys have probably heard the story of the rich young ruler, this man who comes to Jesus. He asks him what he has to do to inherit eternal life. They have a little back and forth. But then before Jesus really gets into the meat of the situation and really dives in deep to his answer, this is what Mark says. He says, "Jesus looked at him and loved him." You know, Matthew's gospel also takes notice of this kind of same interaction in a few different places. He says that when Jesus saw the crowds, he had compassion on them. So Jesus shows us that we need to see, we need to behold, we need to come face to face, and then compassion follows. Frederick Buechner says, "If we are to love our neighbors, before doing anything else, we must see our neighbors with our imagination as well as our eyes. That is to say, like artists, we must see not just their faces, but the life behind and within their faces. Here, it is love that is the frame we see them in." So it's more than the passing high. It's close, direct contact. The second bit of proximity is continuity, proximity in time. We need to have frequent, regular contact with our neighbors. So this means we're going to actually have to set aside time for our neighbors. You know, if you read the Gospels, it seems like Jesus always made time for people, right? Even to the point that, you know, he's on his way to get away, to be alone, to mourn the death of his cousin John. But crowds come to him and he still makes time in that moment to heal the sick and to care for the people who came to him. We're going to talk more about time later, so I'm going to park that thought for a minute. The third one is multiplexity, proximity in multiple spheres. Now, this sounds complicated, but the idea is that we tend to put our neighbors into boxes. So this is about seeing them as whole, three-dimensional people in all the spheres of their lives, not just the maybe one slice we associate with them with. So, for example, Bartley isn't the only one on staff who got a dog. We got a dog, too, so I can tell you about our dog. But it's been a great way to meet people. We've gotten to know so many people in our neighborhood just walking the dog. And so one gentleman, he's a retiree named John, and he's got his dog Penny, and I'd meet him a lot, and we walk a lot. Dogs, we let the dogs play, and we chit-chat, and we talk about our dogs, basically. So that's John. So one day I'm out, and I see him in an odd place. It's not his house outside this other house, and Penny's not with him. He doesn't have the dog. So my instinct is just to wave and carry on, but he seems like he's waiting for me to come over. So I walk over, and he explains to me how these people at this house have hired him to like create a screened-in sunroom out of their existing porch. And he walks me through all the intricacies of how challenging this is to take this existing structure and to build this new one on it. And I'm thinking, wow, this is amazing. I'm like, but you're retired? He's like, yeah. And I start asking questions. I learned he used to be an engineer. And so I got to see this whole new dimension of John. He wasn't just Penny's owner. Now he's a retired engineer who's helping people in his neighborhood, who's doing this work. And it was amazing. So that's kind of the idea, is taking people out of the box you maybe know of them and seeing all dimensions of who they are. The fourth and final is commonality, proximity, and purpose. So this is kind of a, like a really active type of being together. It calls us to set aside our own goals and desires and just to do something of value in and for our neighborhoods and with our neighbors. So it requires, you know, the type of mindset that values stewardship over ownership. In other words, it's going to challenge us to understand that our homes, our resources, our time, they're not just for ourselves, and we should be using that for others. So just very simple examples. This is the sort of thing that happens when neighbors come together to make a community garden, when they throw block parties together, when you have a neighborhood garage sale, when there's somebody in need and everybody rallies around that. That's this kind of thing. Okay, so we've got all this, and I know that can seem like a lot. There's all these different dimensions, and man, I don't know my neighbors like this, right? But I think God has given us a very simple concept that helps us to accomplish all that. It's the concept of hospitality, right? We see this in numerous places in the New Testament. In Romans, Paul says, "Be joyful in hope, patient in affliction, faithful in prayer. Share with the Lord's people who are in need. Practice hospitality." And the writer of Hebrews says, "Do not forget to show hospitality to strangers. For by so doing, some people have shown hospitality to angels without even knowing it." And then Peter writes, "Above all, love each other deeply, because love covers a multitude of sins. Offer hospitality to one another without grumbling." So let's just clarify, because genuine biblical hospitality is more than just entertaining. Entertaining can be good and is probably part of hospitality often, but on its own, entertaining is about me. It's about what I am producing to invite people in. It's what are they going to think of me? What are they going to think of my home? Am I going to get everything just right? It becomes more about appearances than persons. True hospitality puts emphasis on the other person. True hospitality is really about inclusion. This is the heart of God, to take the stranger, the lost, the isolated, the hurting, the lonely, and adopt them into the family. That's what he did for us through Jesus. And that's what he calls us to do as well. And we can see this in his nature, going all the way back to Israel, right? Back to the law and the commandments that he gave to this young community, this young nation that he called his own. In Leviticus, it says, he told them this, "The foreigner residing among you must be treated as your native born. Love them as yourself, for you were foreigners in Egypt. I am the Lord your God." So you can see from those very early days, in the community of Israel, that God wanted them to involve the stranger, that they wanted them to treat them the way he had treated them. And then that idea extends all the way up to Jesus. God has love for the stranger, the one who has been excluded. You can see in that verse, God is commanding Israel that exclusion, that rejection, that loneliness, these are human problems. They're the consequence of sin. They've been there since the beginning, and he wants to get rid of that. And, you know, you don't even have to be a believer to see this. Experts today know that loneliness, exclusion is a huge modern problem. Even back in 2019, experts were seeing that loneliness and isolation were reaching epidemic levels, especially in teenagers and young people. And now those same experts are trying to figure out what are the long-term implications of the last 2 years. Like, what has that even done to compound and grow this already huge problem? There could be people in our neighborhoods crippled by the last couple of years of isolation. This is not what God had intended for us. His desire is for everyone to be brought into the family, to live as brothers and sisters. But instead, the way we live our lives tend to be very exclusive rather than inclusive. So this book suggests that biblical hospitality is the remedy for that individualistic sense that we have, that posture we have. The writers say, we actually need the stranger for our own conversion from individualism, from self-centeredness, and our tendencies towards self-preservation and exclusion. So to kind of take down this kind of fence post of individualism, I think what we just have to do is do some deep thinking, some deep digging, and just recognize, number one, our own resources. Take an audit of ourselves. What resources do you have to offer? that could love someone? And what do you have to offer that could serve someone who is unwanted, unloved, and uncared for? Where do you have space in your home, in your life, in your time that could be opened up to the other? And then we need to consider the others. How could you turn a stranger into a friend? Who in your neighborhood, in your place of work, or the places you hang out, is living a relationally impoverished life that you could invite into yours? Now, these are big, tough questions, and I realize that. And if they're a challenge for you, another kind of neat little idea is there's an app called the Nextdoor app. It's something that kind of became, it was kind of growing in the US, but it wasn't here for a time, and now it's come to Canada. So it's still kind of young and still kind of growing. But the idea is it's like Facebook, but it's very localized to communities and neighborhoods. And so you can create a little profile for the neighborhood you live in, and you can connect with people. You can post requests or offers for help. People buy and sell things. There's a map where you can plot yourself in your neighborhood and say, hey, I am somebody who's willing to help with groceries or walking dogs or whatever people need. And it's you, there's different groups on there based on interest and activities. And so I think this thing has a lot of potential if it kind of catches hold. So maybe we could lead the way on that by adopting that and getting our neighborhoods in on it. It's a neat tool that connects you. And they'll actually, if you sign up, I just tried it this week. I got on and they will mail invitations to your other neighbors. So if you say, yes, I want to send invitations, they'll mail out invitations saying, hey, you should get on the Nextdoor app. There's people in your neighborhood who are on this already, and it's a great way to stay connected. So cool little tool if you want to try something new. All right, so the third and final fence post here is, of course, busyness. Probably the biggest barrier for all of us is time. I'm sure a lot of you have been sitting here right now thinking, okay, but when am I going to fit this in on top of everything else, right? It's a legitimate concern. I get it. I empathize with it. I struggle with it. We have a lot of on our plates with school, with work, with parenting, with extracurricular activities, with home upkeep, extended family commitments, all that kind of stuff. But I think we have to take it seriously. You know, last week, Pastor Bartley read the story of the Good Samaritan. And we see that, you know, there's a priest and the Levite who leave this man by the side of the road, hurting after being robbed. They carry on. And often we'll look at that and we'll see there's a message about religious hypocrisy in that, right? That the priest and the Levite should be the ones to adopt them and bring them in. That's most often the understood message of the story. However, you got to think about it this way. The priest and the Levite were very important people. They were probably very busy people too. They're the sort of the people who wouldn't have the time to stop for that man. So I think this is a warning against that as well, against busyness. Take a look at this image. Does that stress anybody out? What's wrong with that image? There's no margins, right? There's no margins. That's what's missing. But this is how we schedule our lives, packed to the limits without margin. Margin is the space between our load and our limits, between vitality and between fatigue. And the thing is, relationships happen in the margins. Lack of margin is one of our greatest barriers to neighboring. And ironically, it's the one thing that the pandemic actually helped us with. It gave us margin, right? It gave us some time for a lot of us, but then we weren't allowed to do anything with it. That's the ironic part. And now that we're coming out of it, how many of us have gone right back to this again? We just filled it all up again. Well, the book proposes two ways to address the problem of business. The first one is that it's about alignment, not addition. We need to understand that loving your neighbor and engaging in hospitality doesn't mean we have to add one more thing to our lives. It's really about aligning what we already do with the command to love our neighbors. We've talked about this in the past at Renew Church. Does anybody remember the six rhythms? We emphasize that a lot. And maybe we need a refresher. If you haven't heard it, you need to hear it now. There's six rhythms. Number one, listen, right? We need to start by listening to God to get His worldview, to let His word inform us and allow Him to direct our actions. We need to listen before we can obey. And then we need to learn to listen to our neighbors, to listen to other people, to hear them. The next one is similar. It's about story. if we're going to share the gospel with people, we need to understand the story of God, where we fit into it. We need to know how to communicate it. But we also need to learn our neighbors' stories so we can show them how they fit into God's story as well. Blessing. This is the idea that we get to give people a little foretaste of heaven by blessing them. You might think of these as random acts of kindness, but they're not random acts of kindness. They're intentional acts of kindness. It's us seeking out opportunities to bless our neighbors with word, with action, or with gift. The best one is eat, right? Most of us eat 21 meals a week. What if you set aside one or two to share it with somebody else? If you look through the Bible, the New Testament, you'll see how much relationship happens around a meal. It seems that God designed us to come together around food, which is a very good thing. That is good news, right? Celebrate. Everybody celebrates. You do it. Your neighbors do it. So why don't we do that more together? It's a common space. A celebration is a common space where we can come together in relationship. Invite people into what you're doing or join them in what they're doing, whether it's, you know, a holiday like July 1st or a birthday or an anniversary. And as Christians, we should be the most celebratory people. We have the most to celebrate. And the last one is recreate. And this is kind of a combination of two words, rest and create. It's really about the Sabbath. It's the idea that, you know, we shouldn't just be making ourselves busy and anxious by this desire to earn and provide all the time and shoring up our own security and our own wealth. The idea is that we should rest in Christ first. We should rest in what he has accomplished for us first. We should trust in God's provision and then work and create out of that rest. So this means we're going to have to prioritize rest and play and creativity. Now, the second way we can address busyness is through an audit. That sounds exciting, right? Alignment isn't going to help us if we're already maxed out, if we're already out of margin, if we've packed our lives right to the limits. Then trying to align ourselves to our neighbors, that it's not going to do much if we're already too stressed, too full of time. So we need to really get serious. We need to have an honest conversation with ourselves. I need to do this. That we need to see if our lives are actually too full. And so a few ways you can do this. Number one is budget your time just like you would your money. Plan for margin. Schedule it in. Right? There's a few ways you could do that. In our family, we keep a shared Google Calendar so we can see what everybody's doing and we can plan our lives that way. Now, with my extended family, my dad and my brothers and sisters, we actually use an app called Family Wall. There's another one called Cozy. It's another like family organizer, just a way to get you all on the same page and see what you're dealing with. Or another thing we used to do is simply have a weekly meeting. My wife and I, Sunday nights, we just sit down and go, what's going on this week? What do we need? What do we don't need, right? Second thing you can do is just be ready to cut back. Be prepared to make the tough cuts. Do your kids really need to be involved in everything they're involved in? Do you really need to work those extra hours? Is that really going to accomplish anything? Because I think, you know, sometimes when we get busy, it's hard to know when to stop. We just think we got to keep going. When if we're just honest and step back, we go, no, this does not have to be done right now. I just think it does. Third thing we can do is just take a regular tech break. A lot of us just need to set the devices aside for a little bit of time each day to pick our heads up and look around at what's going on, right? We miss it. We run out of margin because we fill it with scrolling. We need to resist the temptation to fill every gap with that and just be present where we are. You never know what opportunities you're missing because you got your head down or your AirPods in. Lastly, maybe we just need to slow down. I don't know what maybe that looks like for you. For us, the discipline of walking our dog has caused us just to slow down. She's a breed that likes to sniff everything. And it's really frustrating because you've been out 20 minutes and my house is still right there. But it's made us stop and look around at our neighbors. We talk to people as they go by. They laugh as we stand there looking frustrated, right? What do you need to do to slow down? So there's our actions. Real simple is number one, create a budget for your time and build in some margin. Number two, start or restart if you've already been down that road, those six rhythms. Okay, so we've covered a lot of ground in a very short time. My goal was to give you some, you know, simple, practical, actionable items, some like early steps you could take to get back into being a good neighbor, loving your neighbors, seeing your neighbors. I really love it when I get a new device or technology, and they have one of those little quick start guides, like a one page, like how to use this. Because like most males, I'm not going to read all the instructions, but I'm honest enough to say I have no idea how this thing works or how to use it. So I think that's how we are with neighboring. We have no idea what we're dealing with, but we don't want to read all the instructions. So I have a little guide for you, a one-page summary of these action items that will be for you on your way out. Or if you scan the QR code, if you don't already have the Renew Church, Church Center app, you can scan that code. If you do have it, you'll find it in there. It's on the homepage. So I just wanted today to give you some really practical starting points or maybe some restarting points to get back into neighboring. And next week, Pastor Bartley's going to take things a little further. So I just want to encourage you as we close to take some first steps, to go for it, just to start somewhere, start anywhere. We just need to start. Because A, it's what Jesus told us to do. The Bible shows us it's good for us and it's good for our spirits. It stores up treasure in heaven instead of here on earth. It's going to be good for our neighborhoods and our neighbors. It's going to bring, hopefully, a little taste of heaven into them. And hopefully, ultimately, we might see somebody come to Jesus because of that. Now, I'm going to steal a little thunder from Denise, because in our staff meetings, she always likes to share a very valuable proverb with us to motivate us. So I'm going to share that proverb with you today. Do or do not. There is no try. That's from Yoda, of course. Let's pray. God, thank you so much for the way you've invited us into your family, that you've loved us before we even loved you, that you call us each by name, and you know us in that way, that you sent your son Jesus. He humbled himself to live a human life, and he sacrificed himself through death on a cross, and he resurrected to give us and show us a new life. So God, I just pray that you would encourage us and guide us and lead us into that new life, to give us the courage to step out there and to love others the way you've loved us, to invite them into the family, to show them your son, Jesus, to be lights in our neighborhoods, to be the most outgoing, the most celebratory, the most kind, the most loving people. And we're certainly not that on our own, but we can be that through your son, Jesus. And it's daunting and it's intimidating, but God, you can do anything with us. And so I pray that you would show us the people to whom you would have us go, the people to whom you would have us love and care for in each of our neighborhoods, and help us just to start, just to take a first step and see what you would do with that. Not to try, but to actually do it, to go for it. God, would you do that for us this week? And we just thank you for that opportunity we get to serve you in that way. Pray all things in the name of Jesus. Amen.